On the record. On News Talk.
With Pinergy, supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
Quite a lot of listener reaction to our interview with Leo Varadkar. We'll bring you a little bit more of that later in the show if we have time to. In the meantime, let's have our browse of what's making the front pages of this morning's newspapers with Fergus Finlay, who is the former CEO of Bernardo's, now a columnist with the Irish Examiner and a member of the board of the HSE, and Tanya Ward, who is the CEO of the Children's Rights Alliance. I'd love to know whose phone that was ringing. Maybe we'll out you a little bit later in the programme, but I hope you're both still there anyway. Fergus and Tanya, good morning to you both. Fergus, can I start with yourself? I put a question to Leo Varadkar to which he didn't have much of an answer, but do you have any good ideas up your sleeve for how you stop people who are frustrated with the way of the world, who see that there's going to be a demonstration, who are fed up with lockdown, who are, you know, have no ill intent towards anyone, who go along to take part in a demonstration and then get manipulated and abused and exploited by those who don't have the same good intentions? Maybe Fergus doesn't have that answer, because it looks like his was the phone that maybe rang out in a couple of minutes. Tanya, I hope you're there. Tanya, do you have any idea for how you deal with people who are unwittingly taken for a ride by those who may not have the same good intentions?
Oh, I was hoping you'd ask Fergus that one first. I think it's a real symptom of probably the problem around government communications, to be honest, because no doubt a year into several lockdowns, people are very frustrated, and there has been a lot of misinformation put out there around COVID. And I think you are going to get people wanting to respond in some way or form. They are wanting to kind of come out of their houses. I do think, though, we need to not overemphasize that bit. And I think we need to focus more on the fact that there was orchestrated violence yesterday. And why did that happen? I know organizations like the Irish Council of Civil Liberties had been saying since last summer that these COVID protests were being used to exploit people, to be honest, and to peddle misinformation around COVID. And it was something that we need to look at and address. I think that's the question that we need to be asking ourselves. I know there's a lot of talk around, okay, should we be regulating social media around this kind of information, and particularly around organising violence? Something for myself, I wonder about that. You know, you don't want a knee-jerk reaction. But I do know that in other countries where they have tried to regulate social media to deal with violence, it often drives the organising of it underground. It makes it more difficult for police and the Gardaí and others investigating these types of crimes to really get a hold on what's actually happening. So, you know, actually social media is really a tool that's going to help people get picked up, really, right, and get prosecuted, because they were the ones that were inciting violence in a process like yesterday. They're the ones that the guards are going to go after. But I suppose, in summary, though, I do think this is something that's going to happen when you get the level of miscommunication that unfortunately is prevalent around COVID-19 at the moment.
Andy has been on Twitter to say that it's kind of wild to him that I had the man who said in the Dáil that the far right and left are the same, that I had him on radio just a few moments ago, didn't ask him about Drew Harris's comments yesterday, let alone his own Justice Minister pulling further nonsense out of thin air, as he describes it this morning on AM. That's a reference back to Helen McEntee, who was on News Talk Breakfast with Susan Keogh this morning and said that Drew Harris had explained to her, it seemed, that when he said the far left were involved, that he actually meant fringe or dissident Republican elements, which is obviously something that he has since withdrawn. To be honest, Andy, when there's criminal inquiries underway, there's a limit to what you can ask on air anyway. Helen McEntee was only citing what the commissioner had told her, and considering that there apparently wasn't any evidence of the far left involvement yesterday, I don't think there was much value in spending finite time with Leo Varadkar going back over ground that is quite that old. Fergus Finlay, I hope you're back with us now. The question that I was going to ask you, that you very politely ducked out of by hanging up your FaceTime line, was how do you stop people from being taken for a ride, those who are just legitimate, who are fed up with lockdown and who want to go to a demonstration to vent their grievances, being manipulated by those who don't have the same good intentions?
Well, first of all, I don't think you really can stop people being duped. I mean, I've been following on social media some of these loony conspirators for, you know, just out of kind of curiosity and interest for a long time now. And I find it really hard to understand how anybody can follow them, because they're so completely, clearly bonkers. Some of the things that were being said at that march yesterday, no sane person would believe. You know, it's I heard somebody on radio earlier talking about the similarity to some of the QAnon stuff in the United States. You know, we maybe use that as an example. It is so clearly made up, manufactured, insane. And it all feeds into and from the same kind of narrative. I mean, I'm fascinated by the fact that this morning we have run down all, the whole country seems to have run down all sorts of side issues around this. You know, Drew Harris made a silly mistake yesterday, and you know, we're all obsessed by that. Tanya's absolutely right. The key issue is that people deliberately fomented violence at a march that otherwise would have been annoying, but peaceful, and they came to make sure that that didn't happen. And you can see on social media this morning the almost the air of triumph among some of them, because they've managed to get people into terrible trouble. They've managed to hurt people. They've managed to, you know, ensure that people got arrested, and so on. I'd love to do a census. I'd love to have done a census of that crowd yesterday to find out how many of the protesters, including the violent ones, are drawing a weekly PUP. Or how many are drawing a full salary based on a government subsidy. These are the people who are there to create violence and mayhem against a government policy, which the vast majority of the country hates but supports. I mean, is there anybody who isn't kind of slightly deranged who believes that the rest of us are enjoying lockdown? Of course we're not enjoying lockdown, at any level of family life or community life or friendship or anything, it has been an incredible disruptor.
What's the point that you just made there, Fergus, about the, you know, how many of them might have been on the PUP or how many are having their private wages subsidised by the government? What's the relevance of that? Surely it doesn't matter how you put your food on the table. If you've got a just grievance against the government, they feel like, even though it's in contravention of current public health restrictions, they feel like they're perfectly entitled to state it. And of course,
they are perfectly entitled to state it. I said that at the start. Of course they're perfectly entitled to state it. They're not entitled to foment violence about it. The point I was making really was this was a protest against government policy. This was a protest about ending lockdown and let us get back to normal, which I presume translates in part into a demand to end the BUP and to end the subsidy of wages, because we can get back to normal and we don't need it anymore. I'm just simply making the point that it's a bit self-defeating to be trying to foment violence about a policy that is paying your wages. That's the only point I was making, and I think it's entirely relevant to make. I mean, there were people hell bent in that march yesterday, and thank God for social media that we all got to see it. They were hell bent on stirring trouble to the point of violence, and as a consequence, people were hurt, people were arrested. Perhaps totally innocent bystanders ended up caught up in the melee and that they had created. I think we can't forget that, and you can establish this to your own satisfaction. I'm sure you have already, Gavin. We can't forget that these are exactly the same people who push Islamophobic theory, who push race theory, who push sexist theory, all over the place. Like every aspect of their ideology and their creed, insofar as they have one, is built on hating the other. And that's what yesterday was about. It wasn't about a legitimate protest against government policy. It may have been for a lot of people there, may have been, and I'm not disputing that in a second. And people are absolutely entitled to march and to protest, provided they socially distance, provided they wear their masks, etc., etc. And there was very little of that in evidence yesterday.
Fergus, you might just be careful that you, I think you might be brushing off a little bit of whatever your microphone is, and it's just causing a little bit of disruption on the line. Tanya, there is an awful lot written in today's papers, obviously not only about the events in Grafton Street yesterday, but about the fact that this is the 1 year anniversary of the first cases of COVID-19 on the island. I'm looking at a whole list of the stories that are in the papers today, and it's pretty much wall to wall in almost every Sunday paper. Is there anything in particular that jumps out for you this morning?
Yeah, I mean, looking at the media coverage, I suppose there's a big focus on some of the unsung heroes. The Sunday Independent, there's a nice article about the supermarket workers. I mean, I think what's happened over the last year, we tend to hear from people who are angry or unhappy about what's happening in the lockdown, but we don't always get the stories about the people who are just getting on with it and have no choice and have to go to work and have to take the risk and expose themselves. So that really shines through. But the other piece obviously shining through is around the school closures and schools reopening. And obviously our schools are going to open for some children tomorrow. What has really struck me, I suppose, about the school reopening is how divided people are in relation to it. So the Business Post has a poll, it's a bigger political poll, but one of the questions they asked was around the school reopening, and something like 41% of people said schools shouldn't reopen unless there's certainty that that the impact of COVID will be very low. And that really reflects my sense in the Children's Rights Alliance in this space. I mean, I was out in the media 2 weeks ago really calling on government to reopen schools for children who are disproportionately affected, you know, in line with public health advice. And I got more emails from the public than I have ever gotten, and there were 50% given out to me, what was I doing? I was endangering children. The other 50% saying, thank God, because somebody's
crying out for the structure and everything else that schooling brings for them.
That's it. And I think what really struck me was the huge contrast to, you know, this time last year at the beginning of the lockdown. There was so much social solidarity among people. People wanted to do the right thing. People were looking out for each other and minding each other. But this time around, I've not seen that in the same way. Obviously, there are people out there going to work every day, doing their best. But there's definitely, the people are very divided in a different way. And I do wonder about that. How has that happened? And I know there's a big focus in the papers around government communications around COVID. So, I mean, it's obvious that was going to happen in the Sunday papers because of, I suppose, Donnelly's outing on Claire Byrne Live, the fact that the government announcement happens the following day. There's an interview with the head of Elderman in the Business Post. And really, it's kind of put, he's saying that there is a problem with ministers doing, you know, leaking to the newspapers. And I know the media loves it because they get a scoop. But there is a problem with leaking before formal announcements are going to be made. And they need to practice more discipline in relation to that. I also think, though, it's not just a question of government communications. I do think you have to look at who else is communicating to the public. And there's no focus actually on opposition politicians. And that's not to say they shouldn't do their job, because of course they should do their job. But that does influence how people behave as well. And what struck me, I suppose, is this is different. We're in different times when we're trying to manage a global pandemic. It's not business as usual, because what you do and say in the media affects how people actually behave, and it will affect the spread of the virus. And if we're not all speaking with one singular voice, if we're not all, you know, backing behind the public health advice, it does affect what people hear and how they behave. And one of the things that struck me around the reopening of schools, like, I know that the unions had a really hard time in this space in the negotiations, and their own memberships were hugely divided as well. So if we're trying to get, I suppose, solidarity, we're trying to get people to take the message, try and, you know, act in such a way not to spread the virus, but also to work together to get our public services back open. There needs to be some work done around how we're communicating to the public.
I do need to take a quick break. I'm keen to hear what Fergal has to say, given his former hat as a chief executive of Bernardo's, about that, Fergus. Sorry, but I will ask him about that and get more in this evening's papers when we're talking to Fergus and Tanya after this quick break. I see former minister and now leader of the Shannon, Regina Doherty, is on Twitter, perhaps with her tongue in the cheek, saying, bring back the strategic communications unit. I certainly know that there are plenty in the party who do genuinely harbour that goal. Mickey is on Twitter, says, disgraceful comments from Fergus Findlay, labelling everyone at the protests yesterday as layabouts, drawing the dole and pushing Islamophobia, typical deluded South Dublin type. Fergus, I don't know if you've got time to get through all of that, but I did want to get your thoughts on the whole debate about the reopening.
I didn't say any of that, by the way, but anyway.
Well, if it's the way people heard it, then that's neither your fault nor mine.
Tanya was making the point
about the divisions that there are within parents, that some who are desperate, who are petrified about sending children back, given that the effects of the new variant are still not entirely known, and others who are desperate for the structure. With your hat on as the former chief executive of Bernardo's, which side would you fall down on?
I think kids need school. I think kids desperately need school, and they need school for a whole variety of reasons. There are some kids who need school because in school you get nutrition that unfortunately, sadly, sometimes you don't get at home. There are kids who need school because in school you get friendship and you get comradeship and you get you know, your pals and the things that matter to you. And of course, in school, you get a much more structured approach to education. The biggest, in some ways, the biggest societal blow of the pandemic, and it is the pandemic's fault, nobody else's, has been the damage that has been done to kids. And every step that can be taken to undo that damage has to be taken. I totally support the idea that it is government's first priority. I recognise the complexity of it. But I just wish to God we could can be even more urgent about it. I also understand the fears and anxiety of parents. I now know that there are grandkids I will not be able to see for longer than I might have been able to see them because they're going back to school. And therefore they're going to be exposed to, you know, transmissibility in a way that they wouldn't have been outside the bubble. I don't think they'll be affected by it, but they can transmit it.
So I
think the sacrifices that have to be made in order to try and get kids back to school as soon as possible.
I will ask Philip Nolan a little bit more about that. He's with us just after the news at 12 o'clock, and I'll ask him about particularly that idea of whether 2 weeks between the staggered reopening of schools is enough to evaluate whether there is in fact a meaningful increase in virus transmission levels. On the general topic of schools, by the way, Tanya, just one topic I'd like to get your quick thoughts on. The story in the front page of the Sunday Times this morning saying that Apple offered to supply thousands of discounted iPads to the Department of Education last summer to try and help with home learning and to help to bridge the digital divide. And the proposal was turned down because there were concerns around endorsing one company over its competitors. What do you think of that? Should the department be so right to be assiduous about not favouring one supplier over another?
No. If you can get free stuff and it can help children to get out there. I mean, what struck me about that, because that was one of the big issues coming up last year when we were working with our members. They were saying a lot of children didn't have access to technology, didn't have access to broadband. They didn't have enough devices. And actually, there was even a National Parents Council consultation with parents that came out even within the last 2 weeks that said very similar things. Children were really struggling trying to get the work done because they just didn't have enough devices. So I think we should have worked harder actually to find a solution. If there was companies willing to give us technology and so we could spread it out to children, I think we should have taken that up. Because I think the real issue here...
Fergus, just one second. Let Tanya finish. I'll bring you in.
I mean, I think the real issue here with the school closures, and I think it's such a shame that we weren't able to pull this off the way the UK was. You know, we didn't keep our schools open for the most vulnerable in our society. We didn't keep our special needs schools open. I mean, in one area that we did quite well was early years. Early years opened for children of essential workers and for children living in poverty, for vulnerable children in January. And that's a big success story we haven't actually heard enough about. But I do think we have to ask ourselves the bigger question about why we couldn't keep our schools open for vulnerable children during the lockdown when other countries did. I think there's a bigger question to be asked around how decisions are being made in education. I think we're getting to see that, you know, with the situation with the Leaving Cert and the fact that it is very difficult to get schools open once we get them closed. I do think when this has all settled down, we need to start looking at why decisions aren't always made in the best interests of children and what we need to do to get there.
Fergus, you wanted to come in there.
No, I was just going to say, I totally agree with Tanya, but I don't think Apple were offering free.
Heavily subsidised or reduced, but not necessarily
discounted
free.
Ones, not necessarily free. And unfortunately, it's the law of the land, as I understand it, that sort of thing can't be entered into without some kind of tender process or competitive process. In this situation, it's another example of kind of nuttiness, but something that's sort of outside their control. I mean, probably takes 6 weeks to pass the legislation or draft the legislation that would enable us to get around all that. I think we've learned an awful lot of lessons during this pandemic about the need to be, about how you act flexibly. I mean, weeks after the government has decided, for example, on hotel quarantining, we're still working our way through the mechanics. We're still working our way through the mechanics of all that and the legalities of all that.
But that's the checks and balances of democracy, isn't it? Like, you don't do these things by diktat.
No, you don't do these things by diktat, but sometimes, if you're at the scene of a fire, you obey the command of the chief fire officer, and you ask questions later. Sometimes you have to be in a position to issue commands. I'm not saying the hotel quarantine was necessarily one of them. I'm just making the point that you end up all the time, and the Apple computers is a very good example of this, you end up all the time
between a rock and a hard place where these kind of things are concerned, because you just can't act quickly enough and flexibly enough.
Fergus, I have about 60 seconds left, and there's one thing, I mean, there's a whole raft of things about vaccinations and everything else that I would love to have asked either of you about this morning, but we're going to run out of time. Fergus, in 30 seconds, there is a debate in some of the papers today in front of the Social Democrats National Conference around whether Labour and the Social Democrats should be one and the same. There are those who think that they're fishing in the same pool, that they're splitting the vote, they're denying each other seats. There are others like Gerard Howland who say that having the two of them there sharpens the competition and expands the Social Democratic vote. Where do you stand?
Well, it clearly doesn't expand the Social Democratic vote. The numbers tell you that. I've always believed that it was a tragedy that Social Democrats broke off from Labour. When I worked for the Labour Party, Roisin Shorthall was a very, very valued member of it. And that all unravelled. I think there are personalities at play here as much as ideology. It doesn't make any sense to me that there are two separate parties, both effectively believing exactly the same thing and saying the same thing.
You're not unique to that part of the spectrum, though, by the way. I do think that Irish politics is marked by parties that have slightly different interpretations of the past and almost identical visions of the future, who just can't get it together in the future over what they think
and
in the past.
And personality plays such an important role.
Indeed, you know, it
compatibility
does.
Compatibility of personality.
Notable as well in today's Sunday Independent that Paul Murphy's rise is now coming under the wing of People Before Profits. So a little bit of unity in one part.
But if you say that Paul Murphy's coming under somebody else's wing, that will start a split immediately.
Okay.
He doesn't want to be under anybody else's wing.
Okay.
He wants to be the wing.
Rise are becoming a constituent network within People Before Profit, I think, is the way it's being phrased this morning. Sin Scalella, entirely. I'm going to have to let you both go. Tanya Ward, Chief Executive of the Children's Rights Alliance. Fergus Findlay, columnist with the Irish Examiner and a member of the board of the HSE. Thank you both very much.